Good morning. Welcome to the roundtable for this 19th day of August. It is a Tuesday, and it's 12 minutes past 9 o'clock. I'm pretty sure you all know this, but if you want to know when our shows are just going to be busy and just chock full of content, it's when you have a busy news day the day before. And that's sort of the way to gauge all this. So a lot of stuff happened yesterday, and we're going to be talking about it today. We welcome you to join us, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, and we would love to have you be a part of the discussion. I want to mention just a couple of things. And then I'm going to introduce our group, and we will get started. A reminder that we are doing this program from Lake Placid, New York, on Monday, September 8th, from 9 to 12. And we are going to be alongside our friends from North Country Public Radio, Emily Russell and Kara Chapman, who are two incredible journalists, are going to be joining us, and they'll join me, and we're going to dig into the demographic and livelihood challenges facing Adirondackers. We're going to really have two separate hours, one on trade and the other on the demographics of the Adirondacks and the Adirondack Park. This is all going to take place at the High Peaks Resort in Lake Placid, and if you would like to find out more and even join us, we would love to have you. All you have to do is go to WAMC.org/WAMC on the road. The tickets are available for the in-person event through the WAMC or NCPR websites. This is the first time we've ever, in all my years, that's the first time we've ever done a simulcast, and certainly between these two stations and our good friends. So we're very happy to be joining up with them on a special day. So please join us Monday, September 8th, and it's going to be the Adirondack Roundtable taking place in Lake Placid, New York, and we do hope you will join us. All right, let's get to the introductions and welcome everybody to the program. We have just a great group this morning. Professor of History and International Relations at Vassar College, Robert Brigham, is here. He is a specialist on the history of U.S. foreign policy. Ding, 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 you win. We need that today. Robert, thank you.
In more ways than one, Joe.
Yes. That's good morning.
Well, good morning.
Very nice to have you here. Thank you very much. Anna Markowitz is with us, Executive Director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead. Good morning, Anna. How are you?
I'm hanging in there. Thanks for having me.
Seems like hanging in.
Yeah. I just got to make it to 11, right?
Yeah, that's right. Exactly. Exactly. Professor Emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University and author of Illiberal Vanguard, Populist Elitism in the United States and Russia. Alexander Mihailovich is here also. Currently teaching at Middlebury College's Russian School and the grad program, and we're thrilled to have you here. Thank you very much.
Great to be here. Thanks.
All right, let's get to it, and we welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. Okay, so the summit took place yesterday. There was Friday summit. And then there was Monday, yesterday, was to be a meeting with Volodymyr Zelensky and President Trump. Then Zelensky said, I need some backup, and I'm going to bring some leaders from Europe with me. And then this became an expanded summit that took place. So leaders of European and NATO countries presented a united front with Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky after racing to Washington, hoping to steer President Trump away from some of the concessions he appeared ready to grant the Kremlin to end the war in Ukraine. After several hours of meetings on Monday, sharp differences remained evident between the leaders and Trump, who declared that Russian President Putin is ready for peace even as he has continued his bombardment of Ukraine and demanded that Kyiv make sweeping painful concessions to stop the war. But Ukrainian and European leaders appeared encouraged by Trump's openness to secure guarantees for Ukraine, which Putin might not accept. That could make the Kremlin the obstacle to Trump's peace deal, insulating Ukraine from having to choose between untenable concessions of territory and inviting the ire of one President Trump. Zelensky said Tuesday, "We appreciate the important signal from the United States regarding its readiness to support and be part of these guarantees." French President Emmanuel Macron also said after the summit, the pressure on Russia would continue until peace was established with security guarantees, quote, which we have decided to work in very concrete terms with the United States. The next step in the process would be a meeting directly between Zelensky and Putin, perhaps with Trump in attendance as well. We'll begin with you, Bob.
Well, I think that the NATO and European Commission leaders were smart to get to the White House quickly. Trump is notorious for listening to the last voice he heard, and that's not the way you conduct foreign policy in general, but that's how this administration does it. They're undisciplined and they're very unsophisticated in the implementation and formulation of foreign policy. I think there's several things to unpack from both meetings, the one in Alaska and the one in the White House. One, security guarantees, they haven't really talked about the specifics of that. Rubio said there's going to be no further sanctions in Russia. Putin's demanded land concessions in the east in the Donbass. 200,000 residents live there. If the Russians haven't taken that area by after 11 years of fighting, I doubt very much that Zelensky and the Europeans are going to be interested in giving it away for free. Putin wants to cap the size of the Ukrainian military. That's not going to fly either. So I think the devil, like in all things, the devil's in the details. And I don't think Trump has a really good understanding of what the Article 5 guarantees of NATO and mutual defense really means. And the administration hasn't outlined it. Does it mean troops? Does it mean weapons? It's very unclear at this point. And the United States doesn't have a really solid history signing mutual defense pacts. We don't sign mutual defense pacts. And it's unclear if Trump has the authority to do this without Senate ratification, if it does go that far. So I think there's an awful lot of things that need to be worked out before this really gains any kind of momentum towards something serious. It seems to me, too, that without a ceasefire in place to begin with, that has enforcement mechanisms built into it and security guarantees, that you're not going to go very far with this. Finally, I think the Trump administration is still caught in the idea that peace is an event rather than a process. And there's no clear steps forward here, no deliberative. This is, you know, Trump says he's ended six wars already. There's no clear way that I can see where we know any of the best practices that go into what sustainable peace looks like that are present here. So I'm not optimistic that they're going to get anything done soon.
Alexander.
Well, I think of the two, just to follow up on your comments, I think that of the two events, the one in Anchorage and the one yesterday in D.C., the one in D.C. is much more important. It's much more substantive. One of the talking points about the event in Anchorage was that Trump was humiliated, which he was. But looking from another perspective, really nothing was accomplished at that meeting. It was a photo op. And this is something that Putin and his team, especially Putin being such a person of the Soviet Union, they're enamored with these kinds of the pomp and circumstance of leaders meeting with each other. A typical kind of lead in many Soviet-era newspapers. I remember this all too well from when I was living there for a year and studying in, you know, 86, 87. The meeting went very well. The flags were all unfurled. Here's an important, you know, meme for this. The leaders met at the airport, you know, with their respective retinues, and you know, and, you know, cordiality reigned from all sides. So this was really just a sort of a ceremonial event. It was highly symbolic. Trump also likes the pomp and circumstance, and so Putin and his team understood that. Really, nothing was accomplished at that meeting, and except that Trump giving a kind of a verbal agreement, yes, you know, we will, we agree that there will not be a ceasefire. You know, that's something that was carried over into the meeting yesterday. But here, I think there's a very important point, which is that the thing that has come up repeatedly in American newspaper accounts of this meeting yesterday was that a land swap has to happen. Now, this is extremely unclear. I'm not aware, nobody is aware, I think, of Ukraine coveting any territory from the Russian Federation. The only way that this term, land swap, makes any sense is if you accept the premise of the Russian Federation that the four regions that it is trying to annex, which is Luhansk, Donetsk, Zaporizhia, and Kherson, are all already belong to the Russian Federation. In other words, Trump is accepting the, he is essentially accepting the annexation of these four regions by the Russian Federation, which is not recognized by any other country in the world except the United States. Right? If you look at any official map of the Russian Federation now, published by the Russian Federation, all of that is now a part of that country and no longer a part of Ukraine. So it is not a land swap. It is essentially, if Ukraine, if any just sort of justice were to prevail, none of that territory would belong to the Russian Federation. It would simply free up those territories from Russian occupation. That's what needs to happen. It is not in any way a barter of territory. So I think that's very important to sort of bear in mind here, that the Trump administration is accepting, already has accepted, the interpretation of the conflict from the Putinist perspective.
Anna?
I mean, I think it was a really smart decision for so many European leaders to come and back up Zelensky, who the last time he met with President Trump was yelled out of the office. And, you know, the stakes were really high this time. Putin had come to Alaska to meet with a U.S. president, which is a huge deal for someone who was sidelined diplomatically for years. So I think the Europeans see that he is a friend of Putin. He literally said yesterday, Putin and I are really good friends. I know him really well, which maybe I didn't say that much my first term in presidency because the Mueller report made that seem like a bad idea. But yeah, we're best friends, and I can certainly get us a good deal. And so I think that the seven leaders, when they went there, they said, hey, we all have Zelensky's back. It's not just the Ukraine you're dealing with. It's all of Europe. And I think that they did a good job of getting some concessions in there that the Ukraine would need. And now the ball is more in Russia's court and they might not accept that ball. And so we'll see.
I mean, to your point, there was what is generally referred to as a hot mic moment. But Trump was talking to Emmanuel Macron and said, he didn't realize the mic was open, but said that he wants that Putin wants to make a deal for me. And I think that's the key words there for me. Pause, as crazy as that sounds. And I think that's interesting for two reasons. First, the for me part. The second, well, it was a hot mic moment, but it's really not unlike anything that he has said pretty much throughout the campaign, right? I mean, that wasn't anything new.
I mean, in the fine print that we have access to about, you know, what the Russian Federation is prepared to give to Trump is to allow American oil interests back onto Russian territory. Very specifically, Sakhalin Island, which has oil and shale deposits, all of the American companies that were, you know, specializing in resource extraction there had left in 2022 with the Russian invasion of Ukraine. Now ExxonMobil would be allowed back onto Sakhalin Island. And that's one of the things that we know concretely that Putin was offering Trump. So I don't know, Joe, if that's what, that's what Trump had in mind during that hot mic moment, possibly. One of the things, anyway.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's an awful lot of territory to cover here, and they're talking about meeting in Geneva, soon. The security guarantee part of it is most interesting to me because you really don't see that as part of the playbook in the United States. A mutual defense pact, a NATO Article 5 maneuver here, that means at some point a commitment of American weapons at the least and maybe even American troops. And I'm not sure that Trump really wants to go that far.
Well, he's offered some kind of security guarantee, certainly money in the form of, I believe it's $90 million, tentatively to Ukraine for, military aid. But one thing that really strikes me is that at the end of the day, the agreement they're coming up with all the European countries essentially comes very close to something like NATO protection. Look, you have all the EU countries are now militarily involved in defending Ukraine. The United States has joined and is guaranteeing some kind of security, according to Trump, of Ukrainian territory. To me, this looks an awful lot like a NATO-like constellation of powers. And even one of Zelensky's, aides said that, he put it very, trenchantly. He said, de facto, this is a NATO-like arrangement for Ukraine, which Putin is unlikely to approve of. And so I find that this is kind of there's this kind of attempt to work around the sort of the perception that this is the whole war is supposedly about NATO encirclement of the Russian Federation. But in fact, this has, in my opinion, nothing to do with NATO. In fact, this was not even on the Ukrainian political radar until 2014 when Crimea was forcibly seized by the Russian Federation. Then you started to get in the Ukrainian parliament a serious discussion. Perhaps we should join NATO.
Alexander Mihailovich, Anna Markowitz, and Robert Brigham with us, and we welcome you. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll continue our conversation about the events of yesterday and how we look at this moving forward, and we'll continue that conversation. First, we have a few messages and news from the BBC coming up next on WAMC. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning, talking about what happened yesterday with the summit between European leaders of Volodymyr Zelensky and President Trump at the White House, and, of course, what will be coming down the pike as a result. We have Robert Brigham, Anna Markowitz, and Alexander Mihailovich with us to discuss all this. We'll get to your letters in just a moment. I'm interested in the European leaders, and given that there's there've been fractures there in with tariffs and so forth that have come in that have damaged or at least shaken some of the relationships. Is there a way that this can does that hurt this effort, or is there a possibility that it can bring this coalition a little bit more back to the center, as far as, I don't mean political center, but as far as a working relationship?
I think you've hit the nail right on the head, Joe. I think that's absolutely in European minds that Trump dividing the nations off and having individual tariffs or a collective European Union tariff. This is a way around. There's always second and third order principles when you're dealing in international relations. And I think every one of the seven who went there had a second and third order principle, which was about reorienting the relationship with the United States individually and collectively. And it's interesting to me, too, that they all insisted, even Maloney insisted on a ceasefire first. And that's going to be a sticking point. I think that that's really showing that kind of European unity on that issue of a ceasefire first, again, aligns with their overall strategic outlook, which is something I don't think that the United States is anticipating at all. I don't think we're not involved in second and third order principles right now. We're just what's in front of us and who we spoke to last. And I think that's going to be an interesting to see how this plays out.
I think one of the interesting things is all these seven, they're coming from politically very different places. I think it's important to bear in mind. I mean, Friedrich Merz is a kind of a brutal neoliberal economist and theorist. Emmanuel Macron is sort of a kind of a more progressive version of that. Giorgia Meloni really comes from the whole upswell of, right-wing populism in Europe. So these are just like sort of almost random examples. I mean, they're very, very different, you know, in terms of their set of political beliefs. Having said that, however, there are some interesting moments. I mean, Giorgia Meloni, she is the one essentially right-wing leader in Europe of a political party who has been staunchly supportive of Ukrainian sovereignty from the get-go, unlike, you know, the many other political parties, you know, such as Vox in Spain, the AfD in Germany, which have been, you know, rather, you know, warm and fuzzy about, you know, Putin's, you know, political program. So that's interesting. I think there's a certain sense of kind of like, almost like a band of brothers and sisters coming together in spite of all their, you know, differences. And that's sort of interesting.
Mm-hmm. I mean, if there's anything that's going to bring a very different group of people together, it is the safety of an entire continent, right? I mean, this is, if they don't protect the Ukraine, it could be Poland next. It could be, you know, the Baltics are preparing for war as well. So, you know, this has a unifying ability.
Yeah, I think just one other thing I'd like to add to your comment on it is that I think that many, you know, countries and political figures throughout the world who have been friendly to Trump are realizing that that friendliness does not translate into any kind of leniency in terms of tariff policy. The great example of this is Modi in India. You know, very you know, supportive of Trump's political program, you know, globally and locally even, and yet, you know, he is, you know, clamping down on really awful, stringent and punitive tariffs in regard to India. You know, so I think that there's a kind of a pragmatism that's beginning to settle in.
Yeah, I think there might be one other thing that these European leaders are looking at. Again, a second, third order principle, something down the road. And that is, however this works out, if there is a ceasefire that has enforcement mechanisms built into it and has oversight, either through EC, NATO, UN. UN usually does these oversights. It's interesting that they're totally absent in any of these conversations. But if there is something, if we do get to the point where there's a ceasefire, Trump says you don't need one, that you can just go to a peace agreement. The history isn't filled with examples of that. But I think what these European leaders are also looking at is how is the United States dealing with this issue and how does that relate to Asia? Because they're very focused on Asia as well.
I thought... Well, pick your odd moment from yesterday, but the one I just thought was interesting was when Volodymyr Zelensky arrived and he's ushered into the Oval Office, and there's a press briefing before anything has been done, And everyone's asking questions about something that hasn't taken place yet. And then it devolved into about Washington and about how the election was stolen and Biden was the worst president ever and so it went into this whole thing. But I just thought and I don't know if you can give any perspective on this, but I can't imagine that anyone within the Trump White House initially thinks, other than Trump, that would have been a good idea.
Yeah, normally the questions come after.
Yeah.
That's more typical. I also thought it was interesting that Trump made a joke with Zelensky about, you don't have elections in your country just because there's a war going on. So in 3.5 years, if there's a war going on, maybe we could avoid elections. And I was like, that's a red flag.
yeah, a little concerning.
A little concerning. Is that why there are troops in D.C.? Are we trying to start a war? What's going on here? It was a very interesting day all around. I mean, the Europeans and especially Zelensky were laying it on really thick with the praise. Thank you so much for meeting with Putin and starting this conversation.
Zelensky wore a suit.
I know. apparently, he also wore a suit when the Pope died. So it takes a lot to make this guy wear a suit. And so he was looking sharp, according to Trump.
That struck me. And then the other thing that I thought was interesting, Alexander, is in the middle of this, Trump gets up and takes a call from Putin.
Yeah, that was rather, blatant. I think he is truly accepting many of the interpretive points of this about this conflict from Putin and his political party. There's just no other way of perceiving this. For example, the insistence that ceasefires are not important. This coincides completely with the Kremlin's interpretation of the conflict. We are willing, Putin said, to freeze our battle lines in Kherson and Zaporizhia, but not to actually engage in a ceasefire. We will not move forward, which means that, we will continue to fight within that territory. So Trump is essentially accepting all of the premises, offered him, that were fed to him in Anchorage, So
you were mentioning the difference between the Anchorage meeting and the meeting yesterday. And saying, the other one was more performative, but I did think it was fascinating that at the end, while so little information came out and it seemed to be not what, we're going to meet for 6 hours. Okay, we met for an hour and a half, and we're going to have a press conference, and we don't have a press conference, and then the thing that Putin says is, well, anything, and I guess this is in the terms of ceasefire, but anything that they're talking about right now is a long way off. Mm. I mean, none of this is immediate. That seemed to be the answer, though, right? I mean, that's like what everybody assumed, but yet ultimately was an admission that that's where we're at right now.
Well, Putin doesn't want to, he doesn't want to budge at all, from the current position, from the current battle lines, and from his insistence that this is territory that already belongs to the Russian Federation. And I have to say, I'm very disappointed in the New York Times for saying that this, again, hinges on a land swap. No, there is no land swap. This is all about simply taking the Russian occupation away from those territories. So I'm a little bit baffled by, why Neil McFarker, who, knows Russian, who wrote the article for the Times, is essentially using the terms of it for interpreting this conflict that come directly from Putin's political party.
Right. And the only thing about that is that Trump is parroting that, right, of when it comes to land swaps.
Yeah, completely. And I think, I don't know who it was who chose Alaska for that first meeting, which is, of course, is very, you know, it's highly symbolic because this was a territory that the Russian Empire sold to the United States in 1867 to pay for two sets of very serious debts. One was had to do with the abolition of serfdom, which was the Russian equivalent of slavery in 1862. The other was the complete military and diplomatic and economic disaster of the Crimean War in 1854-56. The sale of Alaska was supposed to pay for that enormous debt that was sort of created by those two, those two sets of conflicts.
Did you want to add anything about
that? Well, yeah. I mean, Seward's Folly, that was a land swap of sorts back then. I do think that it's interesting that, and I agree, that Trump seems to be parroting the Putin position, the Russian position. But at some point, his Nobel Prize fever is probably going to spike. And he's not going to be able to continue that line if he wants to actually get something done here.
Yeah. We have a lot of letters. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll get to those. And we welcome yours, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. We'll be back right after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion for this Tuesday, the 19th of August, 47 minutes now past 9 o'clock. We welcome you and we welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org, as we continue to talk about Russia and Ukraine and the United States. We begin with Will, who says, no ceasefire, no sanctions, no NATO, and the fighting goes on until Russia decides to stop. Tough to see the art of the deal working so well. That from Will. Alexander, I would like to ask you, though, about the fighting. I mean, that is a key part of this, is while these conversations are going on, as is the fighting.
The fighting in Ukraine?
Well, yes.
Yeah. At the moment, Ukraine is fighting to seize parts of the Donbas region. They occupy segments of both. They're holding on to segments of both Luhansk and Donetsk. It seems that right now the Russian Federation has a slight edge because they're stepping up their attacks in those two regions. The Russian Federation controls most of Luhansk and about a little over a half of Donetsk. And as far as Zaporizhia and Kherson are concerned, I don't think you can say that they really control those regions, but there's hot fighting going on there, you know, between the two sides. And I think one thing that's very important to bear in mind during all these so-called negotiations in Anchorage and D.C. is the level of bombardment on civilian targets. I think this is very important to bear in mind. This has truly no military or strategic value. And yet in Kyiv, in Odessa, and not to mention within the many civilian targets in Zaporizhia and Kherson and in Kharkiv, which is not in any of those four regions, and which is a majority Russian-speaking city. And yet it has been the brunt of absolutely brutal attacks from the Russian Federation on civilian infrastructure and residential areas.
There's another historical overlay here. I mean, Europeans have long memories, and I can't help but think that they're thinking of Versailles and what happened to Germany when the industrial region of Germany was stripped out following the First World War, and it led to much of the economic collapse in Germany in between the World Wars, and in fact fed the Second World War. This Donbas region is the industrial region of Ukraine, and so that's why the Ukrainians have, one of the many reasons why the Ukrainians have fought so hard and so long to keep it. I can't imagine in a million years a scenario in which Ukrainians would willingly trade this industrial heartland after 11 years of fierce, heavy fighting and nationalism away. I just don't see that.
Something very important to bear in mind. Right before Russian special ops troops began to occupy large swaths of Donetsk and Luhansk, the one and only nonpartisan survey that was conducted among people living in those two regions of the Donbass. Do you want to stay in Ukraine, or would you rather that your areas join the Russian Federation? 65% of those people who were surveyed said, we want to stay in Ukraine. So this whole claim of the Russian Federation that, that there's an overwhelming block of people who want to join our country, this is simply not true, right? And right now, 75% of the most recent survey in Ukraine itself, outside of those two regions, should the Donbass go to the Russian Federation, or should it stay in Ukraine? 75% said that they should stay in Ukraine, and that includes people who list Russian as their primary language. Right.
You mentioned strategy and say there's no, strategically this doesn't make any sense. But but that's all part of the strategy then to rattle political cages, right?
Yeah, rattling political cage, I think absolutely. And I think that just to sort of build on your comment about the European perception of this, I think that another aspect of that perception is the parallels between Ukrainian and Irish history, because there's a lot about the 1930s in Ukraine, the Holodomor, which was the forced famine, where Ukraine, which was like the breadbasket of the Soviet Union, much of that food was taken out and not redistributed to other parts of the country. And essentially, assets stripped from Ukrainians themselves, they did not have enough to eat. There are all sorts of parallels, which I'm sure, for example, Keir Starmer is very aware of, to the potato famine in the 1840s, the way in which Ireland, as a kind of colonial, appendage to the British Empire, had its food resources taken from it and redistributed elsewhere and did not have enough to feed itself. And this is the way that many Ukrainians, and I think many Europeans, perceive the conflict in a sort of like larger historical canvas, that many people in the Trump administration simply are a kind of, Americans in general, I think, that don't necessarily have that longer view to the past and to the future,
Go back to the letters. This one from Jeff. Didn't Ukraine get a security guarantee when they gave up nuclear weapons after the breakup of the USSR?
Yes, they did. This was a part of the so-called Budapest Memorandum. They did get that. They also had it was a very paradoxical, strange, a sort of set of circumstances. On the one hand, they had a security guarantee with that memorandum, and the Russian Federation recognized the borders of Ukraine and recognized Ukraine as being sovereign. On the other hand, they, by giving up nuclear weapons on their territory, they acknowledged a kind of a political neutrality, vis-a-vis the Russian Federation. That continued until 2014, when Russia seized Crimea. Right. At that point, the Ukrainian parliament voted to give up its Ukraine's status of neutrality. I think that's very important to sort of bear in mind, that sequence of events.
We have this letter from Joseph who says, Trump not only stated that he and Putin are friends, but he also devoted considerable time to criticize, disparage, and denounce former President Biden. While I did not dismiss Biden's mistakes, Trump's remarks were excessive and even raised concerns about his mental stability. I fear the United States, Ukraine, and Europe are currently facing a severe and protracted crisis.
I don't think he's wrong.
Yeah.
And I think that what's really, you know, from an international relations perspective, this is about Ukraine, but it's about so many other places. I mean, if I was living in Taiwan right now, I'd be watching what's going on in Ukraine very, very carefully, and watching a president of the United States not focused, not disciplined, and not engaging in a sophisticated foreign policy.
Okay, sophisticated foreign policy and engagement. I mean, in the two articles that I read from this morning, the word hastily arranged was used in both cases. I mean, it just you're not setting yourself up for anything solid when things. I mean, this all happened within a. I mean, just from Friday to Monday, much less the whole thing really starting in less than a week.
And this is kind of a 19th century model of diplomacy that just doesn't work in the 21st century. This is Metternich. This is the Congress, you know, all over again. This is boxing Napoleon in. But that's not how peace agreements. That sustainable peace agreements work. We'll go back mm-hmm. to Ireland. Good mm-hmm. Friday Agreement didn't happen like that overnight. It takes a lot of people with a lot of expertise, and it takes careful, coordinated planning and professional a sense of professionalism that I just don't see here. This is like I said earlier, I think this is the Trump administration is treating this like peace is an event rather than a process that takes years to cement.
Well, what they like is great yeah. television.
Right.
You know?
It's good television. It's a good story, but it.
Yeah, this is at the end of the last so-called disastrous meeting with Zelensky in February. At the end of that, Trump said, "Look, this is great. This is good television."
Right.
You know, but this is nothing but a massive self-own for the Trump administration to have this kind of spectacle where it has a certain kind of temporary entertainment value, but it's clear that nothing is getting done, nothing is getting agreed upon. I find that very hollow. And I think most people probably perceive it that way.
I mean, I think he enjoys the attention of being in the middle of all of this and being seen as this linchpin to world peace, because, you know, his Nobel Peace Prize is obviously in the mail any day now. And yeah, it was hastily done. I've organized G20 summits, and we've spent days negotiating how many questions there's going to be at a press conference after, you know, said meeting. So I can only imagine the rushed negotiations that were happening and in advance of this meeting.
Well, in Anchorage, there was the backdrop that said securing peace. I mean, and that's sort of like. Isn't that a mission accomplished sort of thing? I mean, I don't know who thought, oh, that's a good idea.
Yeah. It had said secured peace, and then they crossed it out and said securing. We didn't do it yet, but we're working on it.
We're working on it. Yeah. It's in the bag.
And the way this administration seems to want to play the game is that, okay, this keeps the Epstein files off the front page for the day, and this keeps, you know, whatever's going on in D.C. takeover off the front page for a day. But if you don't actually bring an agreement home, you're going to need some other gold star TV event to replace it. And at some point, you just run out of those opportunities.
Right.
Even the president of the United States can run out of opportunities like that.
We'll take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We'll do all of that first news with Ray Graff. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion. It is Tuesday, the 19th of August. Robert Brigham is with us, professor of history and international relations at Vassar College, a specialist on the history of U.S. foreign policy. Anna Markowitz is here, executive director of Communities for Local Power and former White House advance lead. And Alexander Mihailovich, who is currently teaching at Middlebury College's Russian School grad program, professor emeritus of Russian at Hofstra University. We welcome your letters, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. We will move on to other topics because there is much to discuss this morning, and we will do just that. We go to, I want to go to mail-in ballots. This sort of broke yesterday as we were doing the show. We talked a tiny bit about it, but not a lot, because it was just all we had was a Truth Social message and to go off of. And now we don't know a lot more, but maybe a little bit more. U.S. President Donald Trump pledged on Monday to issue an executive order to end the use of mail-in ballots and voting machines ahead of the 2026 midterm elections, a move likely to disproportionately favor his Republican Party. Federal elections are administered at the state level, however, and it is unclear if the president has the constitutional power to enact the measure. Legal challenges by some states are likely. And this is something that obviously the president has been on for quite a while. But with Democratic voters traditionally more likely to use mail-in ballots than Republicans, Trump's pledge is his latest effort to reshape the midterm election battlefield to his party's advantage. He also urged Republicans in states, including Texas and Indiana, to redraw congressional districts to increase the likelihood of a Republican candidate being elected. The November 3rd, 2026 elections will be the first nationwide referendum on Trump's domestic and foreign policies since he returned to power in January. Democrats will be seeking to break Republicans' grip on both the House and the Senate to block Trump's domestic agenda. Anna.
Oh, good. One more step towards dictatorship. That's so fun. This is beyond the pale. The fact that he's taking advice from Vladimir Putin, his best friend, as I discussed earlier, on election fairness, someone who in 2024 had a rigged election and won 87% of the vote, is comical. I really hope that we can fight this at the state level and make sure that we can have voting machines, which seem really important in elections, because it's just trying to steal elections. So,
well,
nice try.
Yeah, nice try. I mean, I think that this is really a completely unworkable proposal when you think about it. I mean, he doesn't have the constitutional power for this, not to mention the fact that specific policies about mail-in ballots is something that belongs to the states. And he cannot dictate to them. He can say, he can suggest, policy for states to adopt, but he cannot make that, a reality just through executive action. The other aspect of this, of course, is that he would completely disenfranchise members of the armed forces who are serving abroad, because they would be, the only way they have to participate in the electoral process is through mail-in ballots. I'm not sure, in fact, I'm certain that members of the military, no matter how conservative they are politically, would not go for this. I do find it strange that, he made a statement yesterday that I found kind of amusing, which was, states are nothing but the servants of the federal government. This runs against almost every significant strand or tradition of American conservatism. This, after all, is even hinges on different ways that American conservatives have of perceiving the Civil War. It was not the Civil War. It was war between the states, because this had to do with the states' rights to sort of dictate their own economic, policy and political affairs in their own way. This is truly a sign of federal overreach that, you keep on hearing until recently many American conservatives asserting in regard to the Democratic Party. And now all of a sudden, Trump is really embodying precisely that working method and that way of understanding the relation between the federal government and the state governments. I cannot imagine this going anywhere that is going to become, concretely enactable.
I agree completely. And then I think there's a third element here besides the legal challenges and all the other problems that Anna and Alexandra have raised. And that is, this might, this is typical Trump where he talks first and then he gets the background and realizes maybe he shouldn't have said these things. This doesn't necessarily work out politically for the Republicans either. In 2024, Republicans actually wanted to increase the number of voters because they understood where their pockets were. And so voter turnout really favored them in the 2024 election. This would go against probably the platform of the RNC right now. It just makes no political sense for the Republican Party.
The thing I have to keep telling myself while these conversations go on and not just on this, but just on the whole thing about, relitigating the 2016 election mm-hmm. and the 2020 election. But in 2024, he won.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're doing everything we can to change it. And it's like, okay, the system worked for you. And that's sort of what I'm having trouble with. Like, whatever was going on at that point, that worked for you.
Right.
And I understand, is there a palpable dissatisfaction that is different than a year and a half ago?
I think one of the things that they're really worried about is how ICE is going to hit in the Hispanic community because it was, key votes in key places, in key district. That's a great problem, I think, for the Republican Party in the midterms. And I think they are worried about that. I think they're completely worried about that 2024 coalition, as loose as it was, that they put together, is fracturing. Mm. And so they do want to do, but this is this is not out of line in the way that Trump thinks. This is out of step with where party leaders would want to go.
I mean, I think historically, when you have a president that is in power of one party, in the midterms, they lose seats. Like, this is what happened with Obama. He had all three parts of government. He had the Senate. He had Congress. And then in the midterms, he lost Congress. And I think that Trump is seeing that writing on the wall, especially with this very aggressive agenda that he's been pushing, ICE, et cetera. And so he's trying to slow it down as much as he can to retain as much power as possible.
I think something else he might be thinking about is where the youth vote is going to go for the midterm elections, because typically the voter turnout in the midterm elections has often been stronger among young people than among people who are of this older voting demographics. And he's very nervous that it's going to be some kind of a blue wave, in general, I think.
Yeah, and do young people show up in person to vote?
Right.
Is another calculation of
right.
all of that.
Yeah. But of course, I think that, he did actually very well in the last presidential election with the mail-in ballots, because especially in the red states where, you had... And of course, they were very important by virtue, of the electoral college system, where, the voting places were very far from where people actually lived. And so naturally, of course, many of his own voters, used, right. The mail-in ballots.
There's a tradition, especially in Western states, there's a tradition of this that will just undermine. Again, it's him speaking. He's in front of where his party wants to be.
Okay. Where do the Democrats fit into all of this, and what are they doing?
Stop this?
Well, yes, to stop it, but also to ensure that there will be fair elections in 2016.
I mean, I think that you're going to see a ton of Democratic states filing lawsuits. I think all of the attorney generals are going to come out guns a-blazing to fight this. I think the governors will weigh in on this. And I could see this being an issue that is a popular one. Nobody wants to lose their right to vote. So I think there's going to be work on that. I think they're going to be slamming Trump's call to gerrymander. The Democrats are not a big fan of gerrymandering, even to our own detriment. We often bring spoons to a gunfight, not even a knife, and often kind of don't gerrymander our own states because we're better than that, which I also am anti-gerrymandering, and I would like to be better than that, but I would love a federal ban on gerrymandering so that people aren't bringing guns into our spoon fight.
Although I think
when they go low, you do whatever you need to do.
Yeah. Yeah. We have not been doing that. You should tell them. They don't know.
Well, I don't know. I mean, it does seem that Gavin Newsom knows it. You know, the way he's talking about, you know, gerrymandering or redistricting, you know, himself in California.
Five districts.
Yeah, I mean, this is I'm not sure that this is a wonderful idea.
And I'm not sure just from a practical, pragmatic standpoint, if California can get it all done in the time that they really need. There's several steps to this. You know, there has to be a referendum. There has to be, and it is temporary, which might be the one reason they can get it done in this short period of time. But.
The other thing with limited information that we got from the president yesterday, there was the, as I mentioned, the Truth Social post. And then there was also the weird outburst during the first press conference in the White House with Volodymyr Zelensky there. But the thing I thought was interesting, too, is this is not only mail-in ballots. This is also the machines, like, what else have we got?
That's really dangerous territory to go down on the machines in a week in which the judgment and the deal just got made on the lawsuit,
right?
So maybe it's a way to deflect from that. You never know what's going on.
Well, Fox News, you know, lost in that lawsuit. You know, there was
with Dominion.
Dominion,
yeah.
And I think that Trump still has a bee in his bonnet, about this, because, he and many of his supporters, and many of the journalists at Fox News at that time, were absolutely convinced that, there was some kind of built-in software that, disfavored the Republican vote, and there's no evidence that that was true. And so, I mean, he definitely holds these grudges, and this is one of them, one of his myriad, sort of fixations.
All right, let's move on to another topic. I just real quick want to get to the letter from Greg. Well, there's two letters. One from Greg who says, want to take away mail-in ballots, make Election Day a federal holiday. Okay. Well, they probably won't do that. But for whatever it's worth. But Janet's the letter I wanted to get to. Janet says, I know you're talking about this, and I just want to throw in my two cents. The gold on the walls of the Oval Office is repulsive. Well, and that's the takeaway. I thought, well, and I will say, as I was watching yesterday, I was like, I agree with you.
You can't not see it.
No, you cannot see it.
Or unsee it.
It seems to be growing. I think it's like taking over the room eventually. Every time there's more and more and more, it's
you can't have too much guilt.
No, that's true. That's true.
That's how you know you're powerful. How am I supposed to know I'm powerful if I'm not surrounded by gold?
All right. Thank you for that letter. All right. Let's go to another topic. And we have about 8 minutes before we go to a break. So we'll probably start this and finish it up on the other side. But there is the question about what is going on in Washington, D.C. as more National Guard troops arrive in the city. And so they keep coming. These National Guard members 800 already mobilized. The deployments announced yesterday would bring the number of Guard members to over 1,800, close to 2,000, they believe. Two more Republican governors announced plans to deploy the National Guard to D.C., joining three other GOP-led states, as city officials and residents are saying, great, we don't need them. There is this influx of hundreds of uniformed service members in the Capitol, but why? The governors of Mississippi and Louisiana characterized the deployments as aimed at restoring public safety, although violent crime in the district has been falling since 2023. Mississippi Governor Tate Reeves said in a statement that he has approved the deployment of about 200 Guard troops to aid President Trump's, quote, effort to return law and order to our nation's capital. The president yesterday said he heard from someone who hasn't left their house in months. And finally, after his action, he and his wife went out for dinner.
You know, there's a part of this that's tragic and a part of this that's farce. And it's really difficult, I think, to separate the two. Most reports have the Guard being on M Street in Georgetown and on the Mall and not Southeast Washington, where there might be some things that they could actually do to help locals who have suffered under budget cuts that have decimated services that are needed in that area. So it seems to me that part of this is a photo op, but then there's the other part of this that is, do you want Guard in major cities in the United States? I know D.C. has a special category, and that's the one place where the president can invoke them. But I don't think this is something that you want in a participatory democracy. You don't want to federalize your National Guard and have them in cities doing crime patrol.
I really don't. I think it's terrible. I don't think they're needed. I think they're standing around being useless. And I think it's a show of force by Donald Trump. And I think now he's expanding his show of force and saying, hey, now red states can also back me to take over Democratic cities. In my knowledge, this has never happened before. I think it's a scary place to be.
It's a scary place to be, and it also has these kind of very unpleasant historical resonances. I mean, this is, you know, the southern states, you know, attempt to seize Washington during the Civil War. Let me point out that of the five states that have sent National Guard troops, four of them are former slaveholding states. Now, I think that there's some aspect of this that is kind of expressive of a resurgent Southern strategy among the Republicans. You know, they're really appealing to those deep red states within the deep South, you know, that they feel they have more ideological affinity with, you know. And so there's that. But on the other hand, it costs these states and those governors nothing to send these National Guard troops because the troops are all federally funded. So there's nothing that's coming out of their own treasuries. So that's also interesting, this kind of increased federalization of, you know, of the American state under Trump.
The escalation of this, I mean, we can argue, and we have, about the initial action, but then as this has gone on, it seems to escalate, and we see this just in yesterday's action of two more states who are sending troops and more than doubling the number of National Guard members who are there. In addition to that, initially they were not armed, and now many are. Anna, you mentioned about or one of you did about the photo op aspect of this, mm-hmm. and you know, that picture on there's a picture on the front page of the New York Times of the Lincoln Memorial with the Guard members just standing off to the side. It's taken at dusk and the light is on, and they're just looking at it, and it it's a beautiful picture. It really, mm-hmm. like, it is a gorgeous picture, but it is like, okay, so what, you know, what is that needed, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, so the first 800 yeah. were standing around looking at the Lincoln Memorial.
Right.
Maybe we should send double. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
And it's and also to your point, Robert. I mean, it's they don't seem to be where the trouble has been in the past, and again, we've used this word a couple of times today, but hastily arranged as to no real plan as to where they're going to go or what they're going to do.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's probably some real need for help in certain areas and certain things in Washington, D.C. There have been enormous budget cuts because of Trump's actions at the federal level. But this isn't that fix. I'm struck by the falsehood that provided the pretext and the context and the rationale and the justification that, you know, Washington's out of control. Well, Washington crime, violent crime is down. And according to some estimates, it's way down. So that's on the one hand. And on the other hand, this idea that you're having troops, federalized National Guard in our major urban areas to make political points, it just stinks to me.
It's also devastating for the local economy. The restaurant businesses in D.C. have suffered horribly as a result of this. Their customer levels have dropped by over 30% since the National Guard troops have arrived in the city.
Well, these military vehicles in the streets of the city doesn't seem like a great look to me to come in, especially during the summer season.
And this is at the same time that they're increasing ICE hirings as well. And
right.
so you have this combo of just increasing fear for especially BIPOC communities that they are now under attack.
Right. We'll take a break. We'll finish up the show on the other side of that break. We welcome you, panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org, for your letters. We'll move on to other topics upon our return. Robert Brigham, Anna Markowitz, and Alexander Mihailovich are our guests. We'll continue the discussion and include your questions after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our discussion this morning. And very nice to have you with us. Really great discussion underway, and we welcome you to join it. Panel at WAMC.org, panel at WAMC.org. As we mentioned, a very busy news day yesterday, and we've been talking about many of these topics. So, let's talk about the Missouri AG. This is one of those things that I just you read and then you wonder, oh, what's the what's the real story going on here? The Trump administration said on Monday that it had tapped the Missouri Attorney General, Andrew Bailey, to be a deputy director of the FBI in what many rank-and-file agents described as a surprising arrangement. Mr. Bailey would join the current deputy director, Dan Bongino, who, as a popular right-wing podcast host, repeatedly railed against the Bureau in overseeing the day-to-day operations of the agency. Since taking the post, a sprawling task that includes overseeing dozens of field offices around the country, as well as personnel assigned around the world, Mr. Bongino has vocally complained about the toll the job has taken him, apparently more difficult than being a podcast host.
That's weird.
Thrilled to welcome, and by the way, I'm not dissing podcast hosts. God knows. I'm not dissing any because this talk show business is tough. Thrilled to welcome Andrew Bailey as our new FBI co-deputy director. Todd Blench, the deputy attorney general, wrote on social media, as Missouri's attorney general, he took on the swamp, fought weaponized government, and defended the Constitution. Now he's bringing that fight to the DOJ. The move was reported by Fox News, prompting a one-word response from Mr. Bongino on social media. Welcome, he wrote, followed by a trio of American flag emojis, proving one is never enough. Mr. Trump once briefly considered nominating Mr. Bailey to be the attorney general, and during the transition discussed selecting him to be the FBI director. But the president, who likes aggressive personalities, found him too laid back and somewhat lackluster, according to people briefed on the meeting at the time. It remains to be seen what Mr. Bailey's hiring means for Mr. Bongino, whose future has appeared tenuous. And here we go. This gets to the point, I think. I'm not positive, but I think. Whose future has appeared tenuous after a furious fight with Attorney General Pam Bondi spilled into public view in July. He and Ms. Bondi had an angry confrontation in the White House in front of top aides over unreleased files in the case of the disgraced financier Jeffrey Epstein, and over whether Mr. Bongino was leaking information to the news media.
Well, in an ideal world, this would be the first step of adults coming back to Washington. But I don't think we live in an ideal world. Bailey certainly isn't cut out of Bongino's mode. And I think that part of what we're seeing here, I think you're right, Joe, is this is really about the Epstein files, part in Bondi. Part of this is that Bondi and Bongino both have overpromised and underdelivered on a lot of Trump's agenda. And Bailey is even though he is in a traditional sense more of a radical than a lot of moderate Republicans, he does seem to be a little steadier hand on the tiller. And so even though the co-directorship is unprecedented in history, really, at the FBI, this might be a way to kind of bring a little bit more professionalization to an important job.
The appointment of Mr. Bailey bewildered many current and former FBI agents who said they had never heard of a co-deputy director. People close to Mr. Trump were unhappy with Mr. Bongino's display of anger with Pam Bondi, but believe that, in this line, I'll read it. But believe that having him leave his job could undermine the president.
Yeah. Well, you go for it.
I mean, so I wouldn't describe him totally as a steady tiller. I mean, this guy is still pretty radical. He's very anti-transgender rights. He fought Biden. Over and over again, he defended Trump's, stolen election claim. So I think that he is a Trump guy. I think that he comes with government experience instead of podcasting experience, which is definitely a step in the right direction. But I don't know. Is this a replacement or is this a let me put a semi-adult who at least knows how bureaucracy works in the room? I don't know. But I don't think that this is going to be a boon for people who are looking for change. I think that it's going to be maybe getting more done in terms of the Trump agenda.
Also, I think that, choosing somebody who has a law degree is, obviously, a good foot.
You think somebody at the FBI should have a
lot of girl? Yeah. It's a better fit in terms of dealing with the jurisdictional issues, that would come in, to working at an upper level of, management and administration in the FBI, obviously, because you have to know the difference between civil law and criminal law. And, there are all sorts of other levels of interlocking jurisdiction between state and, federal government. He's already served as the AG in Missouri, and so he obviously has some, experience of that. I also wonder if there's some interest in getting somebody with heft, you know, from a state justice department in order to field questions about release of the different categories of Epstein files. One of the things that's interesting about, you know, the Trump's public relation image management is that they've kicked up a big fuss, and this is something that has been, you know, an effort that has been completely, you know, supported by, you know, Pam Bondi as Attorney General, of unsealing the grand jury transcripts of the Epstein, you know, legal proceedings. Some people, you know, in the federal government and the Justice Department have been against this, in both parties. Now, this is not the big reveal that people necessarily think it's going to be, because these are grand jury transcripts that are all but already in the public domain. What Bongino was obsessed about was like a different category of Epstein files, which is things that are already, you know, completely confidential, that are not in the public domain. And what he apparently was very angry about was that the Trump administration was using the support of the unsealing of the grand jury transcript as a kind of a fig leaf for, you know, holding back on the revelation of these other categories of files. And yeah, I think that that's essentially the kind of, you know, the conflict that's going on with the administration itself, and also the QAnon, you know, adjacent supporters of, you know, of the Trump administration, such as Bongino, who are, you know, interested in uncovering these supposed deep state conspiracies.
The other part of this that I find interesting is that we talk a lot on this show about distractions, things that are perhaps used as distractions to get our mind off one thing and on another. But it seems if you take Kash Patel out of the news, like, that's good, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, because every once in a while you'll see a profile and they'll write about what's going on in his office, and you're like, oh my God. But that seems to take away from that as well.
Yeah, I think that's right. Yeah.
The FBI director. Right. Yeah. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue. We'll have letters and we'll get to our final stories as we wrap up on this Tuesday morning. We welcome your letters, panel@wamc.org, panel@wamc.org. And we would love to hear from you. Last call on the letters this morning. We'll be right back after this. Good morning. Welcome back to the roundtable and to our panel discussion this morning. Before we move on, I want to get to a letter that we got from Steve, who says Trump is saying that the U.S. will not send peacekeeping troops to Ukraine, which had been U.S. policy. Why was that mentioned?
Well,
I assume to give assurances, right?
To give assurances, yeah, yeah. Presumably to the Russian Federation, you know, that we won't send peacekeeping troops. There won't be an American footprint there, you know, other than, you know, providing some assistance in the form of weapons.
And I know Trump's a wordsmith, but the United States really hasn't sent peacekeeping troops anywhere since Beirut. We've tried to get that lexicon out of our talking about foreign policy.
The host of Fox News asked him about any assurances he could make that there would be no U.S. boots on the ground, and he replied, "Well, you have my assurance, and I'm the president."
He never changes his mind, so that's great.
There we go. Just wanted to get that out of the way. All right. And I think actually one other letter from Marion. Trump is mentioning a replacement for the voting machines he wants to get rid of. I'd be fine with paper ballots, but he makes no mention of that. I think instead this is the first step to eliminating voting. He has shown us his intent. What is to stop this? We haven't been able to stop his other outrageous actions. I would only say that I did hear him talk about paper ballots yesterday, and the he seemed enamored by the idea of a pencil and paper.
Let's not forget that the paper ballots were at the forefront of, you know, many of these, you know, Stop the Steal movements. So I'm not sure that having paper ballots would be necessarily something that his voters or supporters would, you know, necessarily view as a solution to the problem of voter fraud.
All right, let's move on to other topics. This is another story that broke yesterday. I teased it that we would discuss it today, as I did with the voting story. And I thought, oh, well, probably by the time we get around to talking about this, this will make more sense. And yet it doesn't. So here we go. The cable news network. For three decades, news and progressive opinion on the cable dial has been defined by five capital letters, MSNBC. By the end of this year, some of those letters are going to be changing. Not only that, there's going to be a space. As part of a corporate spinoff from Comcast, MSNBC is changing its name. Now, it was MSNBC, which was Microsoft, MS.
Which hasn't been involved in 20 years.
Long gone. And then NBC, of course, National Broadcasting Corporation, which is a part of Comcast. They are now changing it to MS Now. Ms. Now.
Ms. National Organization of Women.
Yes, yes. No, this stands for My Source News Opinion World.
It doesn't even make sense.
Like, no. My Source News Opinion World.
Go back to the drawing board. You failed.
I want to be, I would want to be a fly on the wall in the corporate offices in Secaucus, New Jersey, where that decision was made, and who came up with My Source News Opinion World. So MS Now is meant to reflect the channel's mission to provide breaking news and best-in-class opinion journalism. That, according to Rebecca Cutler, MSNBC's president. She wrote this note to the employees yesterday. I want to acknowledge that for many of you who have spent years or decades here, it's hard to imagine the network by any other name. This was not a decision that was made quickly or without significant debate. Most of the cable channels that were part of Comcast, NBC, Universal TV Empire are being spun out this year into a new company called Versant, V-E-R-S-A-N-T. The spinoff will require the new company to stop using the NBC brand and its signature Peacock, which are both staying with Comcast, says Mark Lazarus, the chief executive of Versant. This gives the opportunity to chart our own path forward, create distinct broad identities, and establish an independent news organization following the spin, said Mr. Lazarus in a memo to employees. Meanwhile, CNBC will retain its initials, so it won't be CNOW, which just for those of you who wondered, the NBC used to be, the NBC and CNBC was part of, again, the National Broadcasting Corporation, which it now stands for Consumer News and Business Channel. So that meaning has changed as well, but will be accompanied by a new logo, sans Peacock, when the separation is complete, which is expected by the end of the year. Adam Miller, the chief operating officer at NBC Universal, said in a memo to employees on Monday that the change would help avoid confusion between viewers of MSNBC News and MSNBC, as the two channels covered the same news events. yes, it will try to end the confusion that people have been having for the last 2.5 decades. Since the split was announced a few months ago, MSNBC has gone on a hiring spree, adding at least 36 journalists as the organization prepares to separate itself from the sizable news gathering prowess of MSNBC, of NBC News, its longtime corporate cousin.
Well, you want to be a fly on the wall during those talks in Secaucus, New Jersey, to come up with this. I want to be a fly on the wall in those talks in Secaucus, New Jersey, in 3 months when they realize this is not a good idea. You know, HBO went through this, okay, Max. I'm surprised that they are actually spending money on journalists and that they haven't spent their entire budget just on the branding.
Mm. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
It just seems to be the way of the corporate world right now.
There's a peacock out there without a job.
There is.
I just want to point that out.
Without a feather.
Yes, right.
It'll eliminate the confusion because people will stop watching the channel. So that's helpful. I think it is very similar to the HBO situation. I don't know. I think they can do better.
I wonder if there's some attempt to sort of, you know, separate the political identity of MSNBC from NBC, you know, because NBC/Comcast, because Trump has been making noises over the last several months about lowering the boom on NBC's supposed biased coverage, doing to them what he did successfully with Paramount CBS, with the, you know, his lawsuit where he managed to get $20 million, or 16 initially. But it's still ultimately it's a shell game. I mean, you're giving it a different name, but it's still in some ways affiliated, you know, with the parent organization. So I'm not sure that would even bypass the kind of legal assault that Trump is interested in.
I mean, an election, you would have the NBC journalists and the MSNBC journalists together. They would work together as one. Like Rachel Maddow, is that going to be a part of MS now, or is that different? Or it doesn't seem. I haven't seen anything about that of the current crop. Yes, they are hiring new journalists, opinion journalists. But I'm wondering what this means for Nicole Wallace and Katie Turr and Chris Jansing and other people who are. Chris Hayes, Lawrence O'Donnell, of what it means for those people who, while none of those shows get huge ratings, they certainly get the highest ratings on the network. And we don't know.
No.
Yeah. What is the perspective of these new folks? Are they trying to broaden their market? I don't know.
The other thing, too, it would seem to me that this would be unlike you, I mean, CNN is its own news gathering organization, but MSNBC was always had, as the article pointed out, always had NBC behind it, which is a fairly huge news organization. Mm-hmm. So if you cut ties to that altogether, it seems like you're starting from scratch, but I don't know.
I mean, are the ties, just for clarification, are they going to have nothing to do with each other subsequently?
Well, my understanding, it seems that they are, what they're saying is that they can't have the, and that's a good question. I don't know whether it's just, to your point, the marketing of it, mm-hmm. that you can't use the Peacock, you can't use NBC, you can't use the letters. But you can use the talent, or if it is a complete break from those two entities.
Yeah,
I mean, if they came forward at the same time with this rebranding, saying, "Look, journalism has changed fundamentally in the last 10 years because of the advent of social media, and so we're going to move in X direction, and we've hired all these people that are experts in this new media." That would make some sense to me, but I don't think, and I see this happen. You know, you rebrand, you talk about the rebrand, but you don't talk about the long-term strategic outlook for your institution, and those things to me have to be married.
And also, as far as the MSNBC studios, they are in the NBC building at 30 Rock in New York City. Mm-hmm. And so we're, I don't know what that means for that either.
I'm not sure if they're going to carry on a tradition of MSNBC with some hard-hitting journalism, with some of the journalism, the good journalism they've been doing over the last, you know, two decades. If they cut themselves off from the resources of NBC as an organization, mm-hmm. that is, you know, has, you know, considerable journalistic cred or resources, I'll put it this way, I'm not sure how good a job they'll actually be able to do. I mean, if we're talking about creating a whole separate, you know, entity of news gathering, that's an enormous job.
So just in the minute that we have left, there is a great article, if you get a chance, in the New York Times. MSNBC's rebrand invites bemusement and ridicule is the headline.
Oh, good. We're on point, yes.
The rebrand became a subject of bemusement and mockery. A political strategist in Milwaukee wrote that the red, white, and blue design looks like something you'd scroll past in a pile of political campaign logos from 2004.
That's cold.
and Rob Archer, who has worked as a news anchor in Los Angeles, says, "I've just realized that I now work for Multiple Sclerosis Now."
Oh. I know. I also thought about multiple sclerosis. I don't know if that's what you want to be conjuring. Kind of a sad,
awful. All right, we're out of time. My thanks to this great group and the wonderful insights today. Thank you so much for your expertise and for sharing it with our audience.
Thanks for having
us.
Thanks, Joe.
Always a pleasure. We will be back. We'll continue our conversation. Another hour of the roundtable coming up. And we always welcome you. We'll continue after this short break.